Yeah, I'm talking here today about the role of civil society in international arms control. I'm especially dealing at the moment and already for more than a year with the issue of killer robots, or more technically autonomous weapon systems. I think it's a very interesting issue to look at the role of civil society and the very, very central role it plays in even setting the agenda, framing issues, and very fundamentally starting an international debate. I have a political science background as well, so I'm approaching this a little analytically, as we are obviously here not a symposium of artificial intelligence experts or specifically on the matter. I want to hold it a little abstract, also with a view to be able to generalize on our panel discussion. So my attempt in the paper is to understand and explain why this civil society in the field of killer robots, autonomous weapon systems, is as successful as it is. In order to do that, let me give you a very brief overview timeline of what happened. Autonomous weapon systems in general are not defined at the moment because that's international consensus that do not exist at the moment. So it's a preventive campaign, if you want to say so. We understand under autonomous weapon systems militarized robots that can basically take every form. It can be a refitted tank or a refitted jeep or a swarm of vehicles that fly comparable to today's toy drones. The decisive criteria here is that they have a certain degree of autonomy from human control, that is especially in the critical function of selecting and engaging human targets. So that's the technical part. The international debate, if you want to say so, started between 2004-2006 on a very, very technical level. It was especially Professor Arkin of the Georgia Institute of Technology who started to theorize about the potential of including moral agency in autonomy algorithms. He worked from 2006 on with the US military to determine the potential of a military usage of autonomous robots. So that was very much confined debate to artificial intelligence experts at the time, but sparked among the academic experts opposition movements. And it actually started here in Great Britain. Noel Sharkey published in 2007 in The Guardian an article. He is a roboticist by profession. He published an article in The Guardian warning against the dangers of autonomous weapon systems and proposed strong international regulation. This was the decisive step in this very first phase, because through publishing in a newspaper, he reached a kind of mainstream. For that, it were all artificial intelligence journals, which of course have a very narrow reach. Through The Guardian, he reached another kind of community. He also reached arms control campaigns. Year afterwards, in 2008, I believe, for example, the Landmines Action Campaign, as the name says, a campaign that dealt with a ban on landmines, joined in a call to ban or preventively ban autonomous weapon systems. We have here a very interesting factor that I did, identified, and that's my ultimate goal in this phase of my PhD research, to identify factors for successful campaigning here, that we have the benefit in the arms control sector of pre-existing networks. We have activist networks like the cluster munitions campaign, like landmines, actors who really know how to do it. They have the knowledge there, the personal, they have done it in other issues before. They know the venues to the government, they know the international platforms, and a lot of experience in the activist field here. That's a real asset So when landmines action calls for something like that, it is of course listened to in its network. You activate a lot of other actors as soon as somebody takes up this issue. That's indeed what happened in the arms control community, in the International Arms Control Network, if you want to tell it this way. Increasingly more actors, of course, this is still a very inside discourse, but increasingly more actors become aware of the issue and take it on. And in 2010, we had a first transmission, if you want to say so, to the international stage by report of the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killing, who mentioned lethal autonomous weapon as a problem on which the international community has to look in. So with this introduction into the United Nations agenda, where states had to deliberate on that, take positions, you suddenly, of course, attracted also the attention of the big players, I want to say so. You have Pax Christi or Pax joining on the issue, publishing a report on autonomous weapon systems in 2011. You have in 2012 the British NGO Article 36, very influential arms control NGO here, and very big success considering that it all started with roboticists. In 2012, Human Rights Watch published a landmark report called Losing Humanity and called internationally to be aware of the legal problems and the ethic problems involved in autonomous weapon systems. As soon as you have Human Rights Watch as a really major player, you can attract a lot of journalist attention. It is not surprising that the issue gains some traction here. And indeed, in October 2012, Human Rights Watch published this report. November 2012, the US Department of Defense issues Directive 3000.09, in which it effectively bans, you cannot say, but it puts a moratorium on the implementation of autonomous weapon systems into the US services. That means it give the first definition, what do we understand under autonomous weapons, and it says, as we are not sure at the moment what to do, we want to remain at a level of human control that is acceptable at the moment. So they, for the moment, postpone autonomous weapon systems, fully autonomous weapon systems until 2020 or something, and have thus opened, first of all, a big policy window, of course, in the United States, but also internationally. We are now at the moment where a lot is in flux, and theoretically something could change because we are at the very beginning of a process. At the moment, you wouldn't have a lot of losers if there would come some kind of international regulation or ban. And it's very important that they reach this policy directive already to not create any sunk costs in an issue. 2013 then, a couple of months later, in London, in Britain, a network of NGOs launched a campaign to stop killer robots. Human Rights Watch, Article 36, and a lot of other NGOs from all around the world joined this platform to funnel their resources and coordinate their advocacy. And not the least of which, also gained some social media traction and publicity. Because until then, it was often called very technical, lethal autonomous weapon systems or something like that. And that's, of course, not very handy for headlines. While when you suddenly can start a talk about killer robots, I bet that has some journalistic attraction. It's a major framing success when you have a lot of actors in the network starting to talk in terms of killer robots, because that's an easy term now that will probably transmit through the institutions. And it also causes, and that's also what I say, immediate instinctive emotional reaction, I want to say. If you hear about killer robots, most people would instinctively say we don't want something like that. That's general population, that's also within the institutions of the government. Very important here is that through these actions, the campaign succeeded to change the type of the issue. Well, in the very beginning, as I said, a very technical issue between artificial intelligence experts that wasn't very attractive to most people. Now, they were talking about killer robots and about ethics. That's something where you can have an instinctive reaction to. It's an easy issue, we say. And that's easier to sell, and that's easier to lead people to the attention and reaction that the campaign would like them to have. Very important here also the celebrity support. We have a lot of important and well-connected people joining the call. We have Jody Williams from the Antmind campaign, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, a lot of other laureates joining. Of course here, Stephen Hawking signed a public letter, Elon Musk. And every time people like that do or say something, journalists are going to write about it. Now it has really some supportive function. And I fear some data. We have, unfortunately, of course, since it's not really an existing issue at the moment, very limited data, but we have this one Carpenter survey. And that conducted a little research on the public opinion in the United States on lethal autonomous weapons. So we see we have in the general population a clear majority that says, even so, you have to say people were asked like that, they received a little explanation, but they are certainly no experts. But they say just instinctively, that's all right, we do not want that. Even more importantly for my point here, you have in the very institutions, that would be in charge of employing these machines, an even stronger distrust of lethal autonomous weapon systems. That's surveyed by military status. We can see here people who are currently active in the military or served previously are distinctively more opposed to autonomous weapon systems than the general population. So that means the very people in charge of doing that are very skeptical about that. And that's certainly also a benefit for the campaign that you have a lot of supporting forces also within the institutions. Same is true for political active people. This graph shows the stronger your political alignment. The more liberal or the more conservative you are, the more likely you are to be against the graphic is unfortunately a little not formatted. But anyway, it tells you the more politically convinced you are, the more you are against autonomous weapon systems. And that's, of course, important to the political side, because the more politically convinced you are, the more likely you are to vote. So voters are not convinced of the issue. Another factor, as I already said, you have a lot of connections in place. That's one attempt I made here to visualize the network, what we're talking of. We have in red the killer robot network, if you want to call it this way, and the graphic shows the website connections among the actors. It's one way to represent a knowledge network here. And we say it has a lot of connections to the cluster munitions network and to other arms control networks. And they all work together and are linked to the United Nations. And that's a very interesting thing I will close with. United Nations, which provide the framework for a lot of talks at the moment that are going on the state side within the Convention for Conventional Weapon Systems. They provided as information sources for the most time until very recently, mainly sources that are connected to some kind of the campaign platforms. So the campaign, the civil society was able to be the prime information provider for all the state actors that are now starting to deal with the issue. simply because everything else is very technical, artificial intelligence, information that's not very accessible to governmental decision makers, of course. So by taking this kind of information monopoly, they are certainly very able and successful in determining and framing the issue development. Yes. And that's only a little overview what we have at the moment. Currently 22 countries support the ban. Not the most important ones, of course. Not surprisingly, but the point here is that none of these countries in the killer robot debate says we want to have them, or we are actively opposed to a ban. The argument at the moment is we don't need it because they do not exist. So they have already managed to frame it in a way that nobody really wants to be against them. That's certainly a success. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.